for today's teaching comes from Exodus chapter 16, verses 13 through 21. In the evening, quail came up and covered the camp, and in the morning, dew laid around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was a face of wilderness, a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost of the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, "It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each one of you, as much as he can eat. You shall take an omer according to the number of the persons that eat of you has in his tent." And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more and some less. But when they measured with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as he could eat. And Moses said to them, "Let no one leave any of it over till the morning." But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stink. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning, they gathered in and each as much as he could eat. But when the sun grew hot, it melted. This is the word of the Lord.
How old are you?
Good.
How old are you?
Six.
Six. Well done. Well done, buddy. That's so good. I don't think I was doing that at six. I think I was still being spoon-fed at six. That's fantastic. All right, I was trying to think of something this past week being delivered from something, and it's a very big thing, like it is life-saving. But then there's a deliverance that needs to just keep on going, like a healing. And I was just trying to think of what it is. And the only thing I came up with is Revenant. So I was thinking movies. And in that movie in 2015, the main character in the first part of the movie, right, the first few minutes, like he gets attacked by this bear. And it's pretty bad. And his friends leave him to die, basically. And he is saved, and he lives from this bear attack. But then the rest of the movie is just brutal and ongoing of him just trying to make it, trying to stay alive. So I was trying to think, and that's all I could come up with. If you have a better illustration, tell me afterwards, okay? But I came up with Revenant. Why is it? Why do I say this? We see this in Exodus, okay? This is actually pretty fascinating, is the greatest thing that men and women have to be afraid of, the greatest thing is running into a holy God because they are not holy. And so this is what we see in the Passover, is the greatest problem that we have. When God starts coming through the camp, the greatest problem is given by the Lamb that says, we are covered by something else outside of us, and it makes us good with God the Father. But then we see something else. We have a secondary problem. So God's our biggest problem as soon as we're born. And it's reconciled in Jesus. The second problem is that there's an evil one against you who will do whatever he takes to destroy and pervert and mess up. And this is what we see. In Pharaoh, in Egypt, God says, I am going to take care of the thing that will destroy you and use you up. And then we come to the third thing in Exodus, and this is where we are, is we have a third problem. It was God. It was there's an evil one against us. And then we come to this, is now the problem is us. There is deep brokenness that we have. And this is what the desert does. Is God says, I am going to put you in a desert and heal you. And it takes much, much, much longer than everything else. So, we're delivered. But like Lewis said, C.S. Lewis and J.I. Packer and Martin Lloyd-Jones, most of a real Christian life is walked in the desert. Now, I think what I just said is super offensive to capable people. Because capable people are desert preventers. Desert preventers. Deserts are not often looked by smart, capable people as deliverance. And people just sound like Job's friends. Do you remember that? Job goes through the most crushing time, and his friends, meaning well, like hearts of gold, meaning well, show up to Job, and this is what they sneakily keep on telling Job. Guess what? We know life to be this, is that good things equals God's reward. And we know this is bad things that happen to you must mean God's judgment over your life. And it's not true. But this is what they're sneakily trying to tell Job. I want you to breathe this in. I promise I'll be nicer, but I want you to breathe this in. Often, the affluent, the intelligent, and self-sufficient often cannot conceive of a desert as God's loving hand because we are really great at being desert preventers. It's how we've governed all of our lives. Now, this is not my interpretation. We're going to see later this is exactly how Jesus saw things. But I am suspicious of the desert, as you are. Because I think, oh, desert can't be part of the plan. Not a good plan. Not a good plan. Deserts, no. And so I want my suspicions and your suspicions from the text to guide the shape of our time this afternoon. Because I think there are three suspicions that we have. We look at God and we think, oh, you're probably not that good. You're probably not that good. Suspicion two, I feel like whatever's happening in the desert is definitely, definitely not an authorized discipleship program. All right? I would like to select another one, maybe printed by Zondervan, workbook style. Three, another suspicion that you have is I am not so sure that you really love me by placing me in the desert. I'm not so sure. So, suspicion one, God probably isn't like good. If you've been in a desert, you've probably thought, maybe he's not all that good. Okay, now you would say, okay, yeah, he's good like kale and flaxseed in your smoothie, like that kind of good. But certainly not like steaks on a rooftop with cocktails and a light breeze. No, like kale, flaxseed, good. We know that. Like he's fiber, he's the vegetables, spiritual vegetables. Now, how do we know that that is our suspicion? Because God tells us. This is from Exodus 16. This is verse 12. He says, I heard the grumbling of the people of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat meat, that's the quail, and in the morning you should be filled with bread, that's the manna. And then this is what he says. He says, then you will know that I am the Lord your God. Now, this will help you in your general studies. When you open up your ESV, all right, or the app, whatever it is, Bible app, and you see, and you wonder why it is. You see it in the Psalms, you see it. Why do they capitalize Lord sometimes? They're like, sometimes it's not all caps, small caps, and then sometimes when you see all caps Lord in your English Bible, do you know what it's telling you? It's saying this is the covenant version for God. It's not Yahweh, the name that shall not be named. It's Adonai. It's the one that God gives himself. He says, I'm in covenant with you. I'm in relationship with you. I've made promises with you. You and I are together. We're unified. That's the name. And he says, if I do this, then you're going to know that I'm with you. But you don't. I don't. I think we still think God is a persnickety grump, mercurial deity. I don't know what you're doing, but I'm going to really try to satisfy you so I don't get a lot of deserts. Possibly against you. And a lot of us still don't think that God is our Father in an adopted covenantal type of way, a relational way. We think he's a remote deity. And you know what we would probably say to that? This is part of the suspicion. Oh, of course, duh, I'm in a desert. I'm not going to think he's good. Duh, I'm in a desert here. And God says, no. In a desert, you're going to discover that I'm good. Like, I'm yours, you're mine, I'm good. And then you'll know. So for the Hebrews, you guys know this, the Hebrews, their day starts at dusk. A little, about an hour from now is a Hebrew day starting. And he has Mo tell the people, at the beginning of their day, they get quail, which is sort of an amazing event in the desert. I've been to a big hunting lodge where they hunt quail. They got dogs for it and guns for it. This was in West Alabama. And what you do is you have this fabulous quail hunt. And lots of quails are, their lives are ended for the greater good. And you bring your quail back in a big sack. And this is the amazing thing is in the lodge, outside the lodge, you've got these fires. And there's lots of fixins and drinks in the lodge. But you know what is happening initially is some great pro hunters are plucking and draining quails before you're even back. And so when you're hiking back and you're walking into this field in front of the lodge, the fat is starting to hit the coals. It's like duck. And you just smell quail. And you take your knife and you slice a little quail. I mean, it was just shot an hour ago. And you take some off and it's roasted. And it's like you're a barbarian. It's on your knife. And you're like, that's good. It's good eating. I know it seems a little antiseptic because we're reading the Bible and it's supposed to be boring. But lived life, you're like, your day is going to start with some fat roasted quail, and it's good. And you're in a desert. And then he says this, and then when you wake up, so you're going to be quail stuffed, meat coma, you're going to sleep great, you're going to wake up. You haven't done a darn thing, by the way. And you're going to hunt like frost that Caleb read on the ground. You're going to get something that tastes like bread, but it's coriander and it's honey scented from the text a little bit. And you can eat as much as you want. It's A-Y-C-E here. Just whatever you can put in. But I don't know if there's going to be enough. I said it was all you could eat. You can keep eating. Yeah, but I don't know. I think I'm going to hoard it. I'm going to hoard it. And then what happens? Because you're getting so nervous about the future. It says it bred worms. It bred worms. And it's funny that God said, then they will know. I'm going to do this. I am going to hook them up on the daily with quail and manna, and then they're going to know. Surely they're going to know, oh, he's my God, and I'm his, and he takes care of me. He's the relational God, the Adonai God. Surely. Well, not so much. Not so much. That doesn't do it. The desert backdrop does not line up with their thoughts of God and glory. So there's a second suspicion. And the suspicion is this. I feel like what's going on in my desert is definitely not an authorized discipleship program. I know it for sure. I've been around church people. This desert does not look like an authorized discipleship program, not by God, not by a loving Father, no. What do? We doubt his goodness and we doubt the process of the desert. This can't be spirituality. This can't be formation. Give me a book. Give me a Bible study. Give me pleasantness while we talk of God. Give me a tea and my Moleskine journal. That is discipleship. How long is this deliverance going to take, God? I know this desert is going to be good for me. How long is it going to take? Let's get it over with. And this is what God does. He says, I am going to bake the knowledge of my goodness inside of your daily. And it's going to go as deep and as long as your brokenness. Whoa. We are in deserts because we're more broken than we think. Where do I get this? This is from Exodus 16:35. The people of Israel ate the manna 40 years. Do you see that? The suspicion and distrust of God is so deep, so embedded in every thought that we have, that we will need a lifetime of experiencing provision, faithfulness, and his dailiness. They needed to wake up every single morning. Oh, huh, that manna thing is still happening? Oh, cool, no way. I did not think that was going to happen. Hey, Jeb, it's day 8,760. That's 24 years, by the way. I don't know if God's going to provide tomorrow. I know it's happened the last 8,760 days, but I'm just not sure. I'm not convinced. And the desert will bake God's faithfulness into every single corner of our suspicions. Until we trust him. Joe Novenson is a retired pastor. His church, it's a large church, supported and it still is supporting The Way as a church plant. And he's a great man, he's a gentle man, and he has been through the ringer of pain. And if you doubt me, you should look at his hands one day, because he has some of his toes on his hands. Different story. But he tells people, and he sits with them, and he says, and people that are in great deserts, and he says, I want you to know that this is going to hurt like heaven. And he's not doing the super pious pastor thing, and he just doesn't want to say hell, and that's why he's saying that, and you're like, oh, that's cute. I see what he did there with the turn of phrase. No. He doesn't do that. He says, because I know you want to say that it hurts like hell, but I'm going to tell you the desert you're in is going to hurt like heaven. Why is that? He said, because I'm going to admit something. It's incredibly difficult, and I'm going to be honest with you. It's going to hurt like heaven, and it's going to probably hurt more than hell's program. And he says this, because heaven is transforming you, and hell doesn't care. Forty years. We're going to get to this, but Jesus seems to think that the desert is the picture of the Christian life. He views the new promised land as what happens after we die. The problem, one of the problems with a version of modern American Christianity, the version that's dying, by the way, that Chris talked about and I've been talking about, this version of American Christianity should die and is dying, is that we are convinced, oddly too much like our unbelieving counterparts, that heaven should probably be acquired now. An elder who had seen a lifetime of pain and his wife died as he was retiring. And he told this to me. It's always stayed with me. He said this: for those outside of God's community and people, this world will be the closest thing to heaven. And for the people of God, this world will be the closest they get to hell. It's why I sort of don't understand bucket lists. I know, now I'm the curmudgeon-y pastor. Because I'm like, this is not all we got. This is not just the life we got. We got a lot of life. That's why bucket lists don't make sense to me. I'm like, we are going to be bucket listing like crazy. But you don't have to get heaven now. But the suspicion remains, I don't like this formational desert. I don't like it. I don't like it at all. I would like another plan. Okay. I need to know he's good. I doubt it. Okay, I guess I need to go through this desert. Okay, let's get it over with. But why is it that I still don't actually believe that he loves me inside a desert? That's the other suspicion. I'm not so sure that you love me. And this is what's interesting, is when you get all of the physical stuff and material stuff, you're not convinced that he loves you. It happened to the Hebrews. I'll get you whatever you need. And they were not convinced that he was Adonai God. But the reverse happens, or the opposite happens. We get all our stuff taken away, and we're like, I for sure know you don't love me. See, having all of the material things and not having all the material things, we're going to still be suspicious and be like, I'm not so sure you love me. So how can I know that you love me? So God does this. In essence, he says, this is what I'm going to do, is I'm going to begin shaping this picture for you to convince you that I love you. And this happens in Exodus chapter 17, the first six verses. It's a lovely picture. The people, this is really funny. Do you remember this? The people are like, look, Pharaoh and his army are going to get us. We knew it. You're going to pull us out to the desert because you want us to die. Well, he saves them, delivers them, right? And then they get hungry, and they say the same thing. We're like, we knew it! You were going to starve us. You were going to pull us out here. We knew you were going to just, we knew it. We knew it. We knew it. Oh, here's some manna and some roasted quail. Okay, maybe. You probably still want to kill us, but thanks for the quail and stuff. So they get to this, and they're thirsty. And they say the same thing, because we say the same thing. They're like, oh, it wasn't going to be starvation. It was going to be, you're going to kill us of thirst because it's even nastier and harder. It'll hurt more. That was your evil plan. You were gonna do something else to get us. That was your real death murder plan. And then they turn on Mo. They just turn on. And Mo goes to God and he goes, they are coming at me so hard. They're blaming this spiritual problem on me. On me. Somehow, they're putting all of their desert hurt on me. And I'm just like, I'm just relaying stuff for you. They're going to put Desert Hur on Mo. Somehow this is my fault, God. This is what Mo is saying. Not cool. They're focusing their attacks on me. I'm the problem. If it wasn't for me, their lives would be better. This is what Mo is saying. And now they, God, this is Mo. And now they want to rock. They want to hit me hard. They literally are picking up rocks, and I'm nervous. It's in the text. And maybe they were going to kill him with their mouth too, like it says in James. And in this stunning, stunning picture, do you know what God says? Beat the rock. Where's the rock? Oh, it's that one rock, Mount Horeb. Does that ring a bell? Oh, that's Sinai. Oh, that's where the transfiguration with, what? No way. Beat the rock. Take it out on the rock. They want to rock you? Kill the rock. Hit that rock hard, Mo. Hit it hard. And that rock will only spill out life, love, and refreshment. What is that picture? Well, Jesus will be the rock. We know that. How do we know that? There's another event later when Mo hits that rock a second time because he's just mad and so over it. And why is God angry with Mo? Mo, you messed up my picture. That was Jesus. He gets hit once for all. You messed up my picture. You want to know that I love you? I'm going to get rocked for you. I'm going to get beat. Mo, you are screaming at me that they want all of the shame and burden to be on you? Well, I am going to put it on me. I'm not going to put it on you. I'm going to put it on me, God says. All of the grumbling, all of the blame, all of the suspicion, all of the mistrust, distrust. But there's more here. You guys remember when Jesus goes into the desert, Matthew 4, the text practically screams this association for us. What does the text say? He was there 40 days. 40. Like, you don't need high school English to be like, well, do you think that's connected to 40 years? Do you? You don't need high school English for that. This is the beautiful thing. Is Jesus walks the desert better than you will walk your desert. He does the Godward life in the desert perfectly. He does it. Do you remember when he gets upset with Peter? That one time when he says, Peter, get behind me. Except he doesn't say Peter, does he? What does he say? Satan, get behind me. Do you know what he's saying? He's saying, because what did Peter say? You don't have to die. You don't have to go through the desert. And you know what Jesus says? That's hell talk. I'm going to the desert. I'm going to go through the desert. I'm going to go through the desert. And when we turn to him, you know what this is the sweet thing? Is he's going to become your desert walker. Your desert doer. Better than you did it. Better than I can do it. And he'll finally be my Lord and my God, and we're going to believe that he loves us because he says, I'm going to take it for you. And that's a love I can dive into. I think that's a love that you can trust and dive into, especially in a desert. Why? Because in a desert, we are going to find him. Okay? Let's pray into that. Father, our God, we need this so much. Oh, we need this. We need this. The deserts are your plan. The deserts are my formation. The deserts will bring me to you because Jesus went through deserts. We believe that. Would you draw our hearts into praise of Jesus doing this? And would you apply it to our hearts in this sense? Is a willingness to follow your story in the desert and to trust you for all things. In Jesus' name, amen.